All right, good morning. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I CRS. The time is 9, no, that clock's not working. The time is 9:38. The date is Wednesday, February 3rd, 2016. Nothing in this room is working, including the projector and the clock. We are meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. The Title Setting Board today consists of myself, Suzanne Steyer, Deputy Secretary of State on behalf of Wayne Williams, Fred Yarger, Solicitor General, Designee of Attorney General Cynthia Kaufman, and Sharon Eubanks, Designee of Director of Office of Legislative Legal Services, Dan Carton. Today we are meeting to consider title setting for a number of measures and I believe four rehearings. For anyone who wishes to testify, there is a sign-up sheet on the back table. This hearing is broadcast over the internet from the Secretary of State's website, and public restrooms are located on this floor. When the Title Board considers a proposed initiative for the first time, the Board will follow three steps. First, Board members may wish to ask questions of the proponents. This is to ensure that the Board understands the proposal. Second, the Board will determine if it has jurisdiction to set title. In particular, the Board must determine if the measure complies with the single subject rule prescribed in Article 5, Section 1, 5.5 of the Colorado Constitution and Section 1-40-106.5 Colorado Revised Statutes. This is because the Board is prohibited from setting a title for a measure that contains more than one subject. If the Board determines that it has jurisdiction to set a title, then the Board will use a staff-prepared draft for discussion purposes. A copy of the staff draft is on the table. Generally, we'll take testimony first, then the Board will discuss and vote after all testimony has been completed. A decision is reached by two of the three members of the Board. Please take note we are not concerned with the merits of any proposal here. We are only concerned with the setting of titles. Furthermore, we are not concerned with legal or constitutional objections to the measures, except to the extent that such objections relate to the jurisdiction of the Board to set titles or the correctness of the title and summary themselves. Anyone who is dissatisfied with the decision of the Title Board may file a motion for rehearing with the Secretary of State within 7 calendar days. And since the projector is not working, feel free to, you know, come around. I think we'd prefer if you not come behind us, but over here by the counter area is fine, or if you want to come over in this area so you can see the projector, that's fine too. The first item on the agenda is initiative number 2015-2016, number 47, Iran divestment of public funds. And the proponents are here, if you could identify yourselves for the record.
Yeah, I'm Mark Waller, one of the proponents, and Colleen Lawrence is here as well.
There we go. How about that?
Yeah.
I'm Mark Waller for the proponents, and Polly Lawrence is here as well. She's the other proponent.
All right. Thank you. And if the petitioners for rehearing could come forward. And
Madam Chair, Mark Ruskin, appearing on behalf of the objectors.
And I'm sure we all read the motion, but do you have anything you want to add, or do you want to summarize it?
Just this. The measure is broader than the title would suggest, and we think that voters should know that. There are several provisions that in the measure that go to the applicability of this divestment requirement to indirect holdings on the part of certain public funds. And we believe that the title may be not so, without much difficulty, changed to accommodate them. And Madam Chair, if there's no objection, I'd like to approach with a proposed red line of some changes.
Sure. And do the proponents have a copy?
I would note for the record that before the hearing began, I handed both proponents a copy of this red line for their consideration, right, so there wouldn't be an argument about surprise.
Thank you.
Let me just say this. There has been a little bit of suggestion, press release type suggestion, that this motion for rehearing is all about derailing this measure. It is not. This motion for rehearing is about clarifying the measure so that voters understand the scope and nature of what they might be voting on. And to that end, I would just note, and I'm sure it was an oversight, but our second argument that this is a change to statutes and not an amendment is one that is mandated by statute. And if anything, notwithstanding the political rhetoric that was used to describe this motion, this change will insulate the measure from a possible post-election challenge should it make it to the ballot and should it pass. So with all due respect to the proponents of the measure, and while I don't typically expect thank you notes for motions for rehearing, this motion is about making this title legally compliant. And we think that the change that Mr. Ward has indicated on your screen goes to that, as does the first change in our draft. And then the various changes that you see in the red line provided to you, which we would ask the board retain for its records, go to the arguments raised as the first argument about why this title fails to adequately address the indirect investments that are covered by the text of the measure. But because I know you've read the motion and because I know you're familiar with the initiative itself, I won't go into the specifics unless there are questions, Madam Chair.
So you're not challenging the single subject, just the text of the question.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Questions from the board?
I do have one.
Sure.
And in regard to the draft that you provided us, and thinking of your first argument in terms of various changes, the first place I thought of specifying direct or indirect was actually in an earlier phrase about the creation of the list of the Iran-restricted companies in which the public fund has or may have holdings, and whether it might be helpful there, because I believe the text of the measure requires it for both direct and indirect holdings.
I believe that that is an accurate change, that given the breadth of the measure, the list also ought to reflect
that
in direct or indirect language.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks. If I could hear from the proponents of the measure, you have Mr. Gruskin's suggested language in front of you. Do you want to speak off that, or you want to speak to the motion in general?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy talking to Mr. Gruskin's proposed language, and we do appreciate changing the verbiage from amendment to a change to statute. Representative Court would be very upset with me for having this language wrong in the first place, so I do appreciate that very much. And I think regarding the rest of the proposed change here from Mr. Gruskin, I think for the most part we tend to agree with him. However, once we get down to the bottom, I don't think, you know, when we're down from the fourth line from the bottom, that he's got a proposed change that, you know, about two-thirds of the way through the sentence starts with requests that managers of private equity funds in the public fund avoid participation in Iran-restricted companies. I don't think that's accurate, actually. And if, you know, he would like to provide us some more explanation of why he feels that is actually what's in the language of the proposed statutory change, I'm happy to listen to that. But as I read that, that just doesn't – I don't think that's what our proposed statutory change says. But other than that, I think if we just strike that, I think we'd be just fine. And we're happy with the rest of it.
Okay. All right. Thanks. So, Sharon, was your thought that we put the direct and indirect part in the list and then continue to refer back to the list, or?
Well, I have to admit that sort of the direct and indirect holdings versus the active and inactive activities. I mean, you go back and forth. I mean, it's somewhat confusing. I mean, it's just detailed. It's a very detailed proposal. The first place that I thought of in terms of clarifying that it applied to both direct or indirect was the phrase that I indicated, which is about the creation of the list, because I do believe that's accurate, that the list is supposed to include companies that have direct or indirect holdings. I don't know that I went quite so far as Mr. Gruskin's proposed draft changes in terms of all the other references, because sort of once you made the initial statement whether you needed to specify direct and indirect throughout, and I'm open to that discussion, but that's just initially how I thought of it, that seemed the first place to specify that it applied to direct and indirect.
Mr. Gruskin, did you want to speak to the private equity fund?
Again, for the record, this is Mark Gruskin on behalf of the objectors. On the final text proposed by the proponents, page 5, there is a proposed subsection 24-54.8-203 that relates to private equity. And that's exactly where this is found. This is not a requirement that exists in the current statutes. And this 203 paren 5, entitled private equity, makes it clear that that public funds must annually notify managers of private equity assets of this policy in order to avoid the Iran restricted companies and request the managers not make such investments. So the word engage may not be the proper verb, but this is basically the preemptive strike relative to private equity funds or private equity assets in which a public fund were to invest that is important. So in other words, this is a reflection of the policy that not only must there be divestment, but there must be prospective avoidance of any related investments. And so it's really a more comprehensive prohibition that voters ought to understand. So to Mr. Wallard's, Representative Wallard's point, we believe this is expressly provided for in the measure, and we think that the language is relatively innocuous in that it doesn't push voters one way or the other, but it certainly does provide them with important information for their consideration.
Start
you
with
go
the easy stuff?
Sure, yeah. A change?
Yes.
Sorry.
Let's do that one, and then we can move on to the other issues.
Okay,
so as the draft, the title for 47 has been adopted, it's now showing that it would say a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes on line 1 rather than an amendment. And I would move that change.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right.
So then I would go down to lines 6 and 7, where Stephen has inserted the language direct or indirect before the word holdings on line 7. So this is the phrase about creating the list of companies. And so I would move that change.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All right.
And then I guess I don't know that I feel strongly one way or the other. It seems to me that once we've talked about companies that have direct or indirect holdings, I don't know if it's necessary to specify that the divestment has to be of one
right.
or both or either.
That was my thought. We put it in the list.
And so if we go that route, then we wouldn't make changes on line 8.
Should we, sorry to interrupt, can I
no,
interrupt?
This one.
Instead of using the direct and indirect holdings in companies, would it be helpful to say listed companies?
Or just not acquire holdings.
Well, they're not really listed yet until, right?
Well, I think once they're on the list, then
yeah,
they're
then
sent
they're
the notice.
Yeah.
So again, it seems to me that if they're listed because they have direct or indirect, then that sort of carries forward in terms of the notice requirement, and we don't have to specifically state that. And this, I think that would be the same argument on the next phrase about actual divesting, that you don't have to specify, but yeah, to maybe to say divest from listed companies, just like we did in the earlier phrase.
Right.
So I would move that change on line 8 to insert the word listed before companies.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
I think I.
Aye.
That's your job.
Aye.
Okay.
What if instead of saying not acquired direct holdings, just holdings in listed companies?
Yeah, I think that the language is kind of redundant again.
I think that would be consistent with the approach we're taking.
Yeah.
So it would read after the semicolon, not acquire holdings in listed companies.
Yes.
I move the change.
I move that change on lines 9 and 10. Of the red line.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Now we get to the next.
Right, and this is a little bit thornier, it seems.
I mean, I think it's if you track the language, it's you notify the managers, it's not engage with.
Well, there's two provisions. And I think that, first of all, Mr. Gruskin is suggesting that we insert one phrase to cover what's in subsection 4. Of 203, which deals with defined contribution plans, which is separate and apart from then the issue in the next phrase dealing with the private equity, which is in subsection 5 of that statutory provision. And so I think there's actually two issues here. Is one, whether or not there should be a clause, a phrase describing what's set forth or required in subsection 4 about defined contribution plans. Am I correct, Mr. Gruskin?
That's correct.
Okay, that there's two separate issues. And then whether or not we're describing correctly the phrase that we included initially in the title at our last meeting,
whether that's accurate and needs to be tweeted or to be fixed. So I think the issue is whether or not there needs to be a phrase inserted to cover subsection 4's requirements about defined contribution plans, which is engaging managers of the plan to request that they remove listed companies from their offerings or create an alternative investment offering devoid of listed companies.
I guess I just don't see it as central to the measure. I mean, the point of the measure is divesting funds, how that happens, or I mean, we already got into the creation of a list. Who gives the list to who is, I just don't know that a voter would care.
Well, a lot of the details in this title may not
right,
make
but,
a lot of sense
I mean,
to most
Yeah, I
voters.
Just don't
That's
know,
true.
But that one I think, I don't know that a voter, there's nothing surreptitious about it. I don't know that a voter is going to vote one way or another based on who has to give the list.
I think I agree with that, because what's important and central is not the request, but the consequence, which is already spelled out, which is that if those managers invest in restricted assets, those assets will be divested from, which is already covered earlier, right? And so your point is the notification and engagement of subsections 4 and 5 are just mechanisms by which divestment occurs.
Yeah, I mean, essentially what this is saying is, you know, some administrator of some plan has to contact some administrator of some other plan, and, you know, I mean, that just, I mean, Mr. Gruskin, you can tell me why you think that's important, but.
Well, I'd go back to my comment earlier. There, divestment is taking public funds, or taking, well, in this instance, public funds, and bringing them out of an existing investment. This is about changing a prospective investment policy. So it seems to me that it is as important for voters to know that this is a forward-going policy, and that it is specific to the types of funds, whether it's private equity or the defined contribution plans of the public funds, as it is to know that what exists at a particular moment, the effective date of the measure, will be divested. And the mere fact that you create a list of Iran-restricted companies doesn't connote either the forward-going nature of this prohibition or the breadth of the nature. I understand that the title board struggles with how much detail to provide as in its definition of public funds, but it is important that the people who are affected by these types of holdings know that. And that's why the recommended language, which does not significantly lengthen the title, and with the exception of maybe a wording issue or two, I think the proponents don't have a major concern about.
Well, I just think it's covered by divest from listed companies. And then the next is not acquire holdings in listed companies. I mean, what's left? You've divested and you can't acquire holdings. What else are you doing? That's the prospective nature, and it's the divestment. How is getting into the details of how that happens helping?
What if we were to do this? Rather than quibble over how that phrase, well, what if you were to do this, because I don't really have a vote, but on line 10, the phrase that becomes request that managers of indirect holdings, if you took that phrase out, then it would not be misleading as to the nature of the types of funds that are affected.
I would prefer to take it out personally, but I mean...
Yeah. Mark Waller for the proponents. I think I agree with that. I do agree with that.
Agree with which?
Taking out, just take out that line and then we're left with divesting and not acquiring, and we're out of the whole whatever the managers are doing business.
And I was sort of seeing if there was sort of some place in between the two positions of not having anything in there and overly detailed about, in terms of this concept of future investment or participation, just to talk about more generally rather than specifically something about require certain actions to avoid investment or participation in listed companies by the private, by private equity assets, and the other terminology is about defined contribution plans. Something, I'm not there yet, but that's sort of the direction I was going, where you could have the concept without all the specifics about exactly what has to be done, if that's important, especially in terms of defined contribution plans and private equity funds. But if we want to go the other way, that's fine too.
I'm always for less is more, but for
I support taking out that sentence.
Okay, that's fine.
All right. You want to move it?
It's not a sentence. It's a clause, I suppose. Yeah. I move the changes reflected in lines 10 and 11.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Anything else from either proponents or opponents?
Nothing from the proponents.
And the same for the objectors. Huh. I mean, I will just note for the record that I know that the board has defaulted to the phrase listed companies, and a very careful reading of the title would allow the unwary petition signer or voter to know what that means. But direct or indirect is still the more explicit way of letting people know in each of these instances how broad this measure is. And given the fact that you've just struck a phrase, I'd argue for clarity, and adding two words in a couple of different places so that you're not requiring people to refer back to that reference to the list. Other than that, you want to comment. Yeah.
So would your suggestion be inserting the Iran restricted terminology between listed and companies, like on line 7 or on line 8? Is that what you're suggesting, Mr. Grusin?
I think he's going back to divest from direct and indirect holdings and then not acquire direct or indirect holdings.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
The chair has captured my meaning, even if I didn't express it.
Well, it's here on paper, so it was easy.
Okay. For consistency's sake, on line 11, I'd prefer to remove Iran restricted and replace that with listed.
We think that's a good change.
I move change on line 11.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All right. I'm going to go ahead and read the question into the or the statement into the record. So as it reads now, it's a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes prohibiting the investment of public funds in companies that conduct specified business operations with the Islamic Republic of Iran, and in connection therewith specifying such companies as Iran-restricted companies, defining public funds as monies of the state of Colorado, the Regional Transportation District, and certain government retirement organizations, and requiring administrators of each public fund to create a list of Iran-restricted companies in which the public fund has or may have direct or indirect holdings. Send written notice to the listed companies to notify them of the possibility of divestment if active business operations continue. Divest from listed companies that continue to have active business operations after receiving notice from the public fund. Not acquire holdings in listed companies and prepare annual reports regarding the public fund's divestment from listed companies.
So I think where we'd be is in regard to the motion for rehearing on number 47, that we grant the motion for rehearing for those issues and changes as reflected in the title and deny all other requests.
Second.
All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. And Mr. Gruskin, I know we never send out thank you notes, but I actually think every time we do a rehearing, the question is better. And sometimes I wonder what I was thinking the first time around. So anyway, appreciate the advocacy on these questions. The next one is, oh, yeah, and we're switching out. Jason Gallander will be joining us from Office of Legislative Legal, as he was the board member on public accountability of officials, which is measure 2015-2016, number 73. And if the proponents are here, if you could come up to the podium, identify yourselves.
Mike Spalding, proponent.
David Odke, proponent.
All right. And we have a motion for rehearing that was filed. And Mr. Gruskin, if you want to come forward and tell us who you're representing and if you want to sum up your...
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Mark Gruskin on behalf of the objector, Philip Hayes. If Groundhog Day weren't yesterday, I'd feel like it was today for a variety of reasons.
This would have been perfect.
Right? Right?
I'll take Sonny and share myself.
The motion for rehearing, I believe, speaks for itself. I would note just that I think that the board started off on its single subject inquiry last time. Mr. Gallander appropriately quoted the decision in number 76 and then opined that, well, maybe the single subject topic is a closed question. And I think the maybe was the operative word, because the Supreme Court clearly, by its terms in footnote 2 in that decision, did not rule on a number of single subject issues that were raised in that challenge. Instead, it seemed to hold them out as being issues for consideration should the matter come back to the court. And guess what? Some of those issues are still in this measure, and the measure is problematic for that reason. Specifically, in our motion for rehearing, the first two issues on page 2, A and B, were issues that were expressly reserved by the court in footnote 2 as not issues that it was addressing in its single subject determination. And this is the question of whether or not expanding a petition to apply to four different office holders violates the single subject, both by violating what is, in essence, a single subject requirement for recall petitions, and also by allowing a recall petition to undertake the simultaneous recall of officials who have absolutely nothing to do with one another. In the city and county of Denver, you could recall the mayor and the auditor and a city councilor, for instance. In the state of Colorado, you could recall the governor and a member of the Board of Education and a statewide regent if the The latter two offices were both statewide in nature, as well as other statewide officers. These are individuals that perform different functions, have different levels and reasons for accountability, and have absolutely nothing to do with one another. And they can and very possibly would be on the same petition, regardless of how that gets lived out. That violates the single subject requirement by requiring voters to decide that, in fact, they like certain parts of the procedural changes, but they then have to decide whether or not they also like the ability of certain citizen groups to recall unrelated offices. Argument C is not an issue that was raised in the decision or the opinion on number 76. The point being that this measure adds a qualification to every elected office in the state of Colorado at every single level. And it does so as to state measures. It even does so as to local measures, as the measure is expressly applicable to home rule jurisdictions. It even will change the ability, for instance, of a person to stand for election as a municipal judge in Inglewood. We think that that is a single subject issue because the issue of qualifications for office is its own subject, and the Supreme Court has held that over and over and over again on the judicial qualifications measures. Our fourth argument in terms of single subject is that the home rule control has been eliminated. If you like the idea of recall being more accessible under the measures as proposed for certain types of offices, you may or may not like the ability of the statewide voters to supplant the ability of local voters to have a charter provision that relates to any part of the election process or the recall. And we would suggest to you that that is problematic. And in fact, as suggested, that will impact both provisions in the Constitution and specific home rule jurisdictions, as well as general home rule jurisdictions. People ought not have to decide that the election authority is compromised for that reason. And lastly, on a more basic nature, the measure basically does away with home rule control over elections of this sort. And we think that doing away with that level of local control is its own subject. And I won't go into the issues that relate to the accuracy of the title, pending a decision of the board on the single subject of this measure, which, as we said, both in writing and here this morning, is very much an open issue.
I just have a question, I think, for the proponents.
Mike Spaulding, proponent.
This is about the part of the measure that says you can't be an official or shall not be any official. What is an official?
Well, over time, we have narrowed that definition. It's at the first couple words of the initiative, and it's legislative or executive. So this does not apply to judges in any way, although it used to.
Right. And it doesn't apply to appointed officials. I mean, that's not your intent.
Right. It's just legislative and executive.
So that refers to Section 1's all state and local legislative and executive elective officials. That's sort of a definitional provision?
Right.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay. Any other questions?
No. Not for me.
Okay.
Um, think I do have a couple of questions for Mr. Gruskin about his argument. First question, of course, and I'm not sure it necessarily matters too much to my analysis, but I am curious. I mean, to me, it wasn't entirely clear, as Ms. Steyer's question indicated, whether officials, the timeout period for any elective office applied only to legislative and executive branch. The proponents say that's his intent. Are you willing to go along with that, or are you still holding to that this applies to everybody?
Well, it applies to any elected official in the state of Colorado. The fact that their measure has a general accountability statement doesn't define official at all. And as a matter of fact, if you take a look at Section 3, enforcement, elective means an office subject to election even if term limited. So to the extent that there is a qualifier on who is an official, it's who is elected to office. And as noted in our motion, there are municipal judges that are elected to office. And therefore, to the extent that there is a question, I don't know that it's answered by the text of the measure.
Mr. Gruskin, maybe this helps, or maybe you don't read it that way, but Section 1 says, all state and local legislative and executive elective officials shall also be accountable to the voters in the manner stated in this article. You don't read that to be restrictive as to only legislative and executive. You read that to apply to judicial as well?
I think that there is... That there is no limitation. I don't know why also is in there, but also suggests that it is inclusive and not exclusive rather than somehow definitional. Well, I mean, I honestly, Mr. Yeager, I don't know, but I don't think that the text forecloses the ability of citizens who seek to recall, for instance, an elected municipal judge to do so.
I understand your argument. Thanks.
Okay. I do have another question, Mr. Gruskin, about the scope of home rule here. Is it your belief that recall as now does not... I guess I say that home rule power relative to qualifications is so exclusive that recall provisions can't override them. Or I guess what I'm saying is I'm not entirely clear that this essentially timeout period for someone who's been recalled is a qualification exactly. I mean, it's a disqualification, but it's not... It seems to me it's telling a home rule, well, here's certain people because of an action they've taken that you can't have as a person elected office. And we have other provisions like that for if you're currently serving a term for a felony, and I believe those apply across the board. I'm just not convinced necessarily that home rule power currently is really unlimited in this area, and I want to know your take on that.
Well, first of all, the argument about qualifications applies twofold. One, as to state officials, for instance, but also as to home rule. So you could agree that this is a disqualification and therefore an added limitation on who can run for office, and it could apply just at the state level, and we'd be in agreement. As to whether or not the state has the authority to limit home rule determinations as to qualifications, I think this is a qualification. Just as you cannot be 15 years old and run for any office in the state of Colorado. You have to be a voter.
Right. And do you think that that requirement applies to a home rule, or can a home rule let 15-year-olds run for office?
I don't know if that's ever been tested, but I think that it I think it does apply to home rule through the provisions in the Constitution that are not exclusive. For instance, the provisions that are cited, Denver, Broomfield, and just the general Article 20, Section 6, allow those qualifications to be determined at the local level. So I suppose that if City and County of Denver changed its charter to allow 15-year-olds to run for mayor, that under the existing Article 20, Section 6, they could do so.
Because where I'm leaning on this, I think, is with this, that this cooling off period or prohibition on running for someone who's been recalled is essentially an integral part of the initiative and of recall, and that it's saying it's sort of an increased consequence for being recalled, which seems to me that it wouldn't be inconsistent with the general thrust of the initiative. You know, I don't think it's a voter surprise issue or something, a log rolling issue. I mean, I think a voter who wants to expand the power of recall and make it somewhat easier to recall procedurally, I think it's pretty consistent with that to have such a cooling off period. Are you familiar with the Burns and v. City of Boulder case?
Yes, I am.
Isn't in that case, for the audience, essentially the holding was that a city may not allow a recall, a home rule city may not allow a recalled officer to succeed himself. You know, to me, that's as much a qualification as this is, and it said basically that the existing recall law in a circumstance can trump whole rule, so home rules, with regard to a qualification. How does that not undermine your argument here?
Because remember what the court said in number 76, the single subject was not everything dealing with recall. It was the manner in which recall elections are triggered and conducted. That was the express holding of the Supreme Court. This, I'm not saying this is unrelated to recall. This simply has nothing to do with the manner in which recall elections are triggered and conducted. In other words, process leading up to an election day on the recall. That is the single subject that the court identified in number 76. This is a measure that says 2, 4, 6 years after that election day, in other words, the day in which the election was conducted, we can control and determine whether or not if you were recalled for a local office, you can run for state office. Whether or not if you were recalled as a special district commissioner, you can run for attorney general. One has absolutely nothing to do with the other. So I understand your point. But I think that the board is constrained by what the court identified in number 76 as the bulk of the measure then, before it, and this measure, which is those procedures leading up to the day of a recall election.
Well, I think that we probably need to describe that better in the measure. I'm not sure it makes me believe there's two subjects. One of my issues with the way that it's worded is that I think this accountability language is restrictive on who can be recalled, but I don't know that that restriction then carries over into this prohibition language where it says recalled officials and those who resign shall not be any official for 6 years. I mean, I think that could potentially be interpreted to mean a public official of any sort, appointed, a judge, a elected. It doesn't have that elected language in there. And, you know, again, while I think that this language up top on accountability restricts who's subject to the recall, I don't necessarily think it carries over into that section where it now says any official. And so, you know, where we put the language in here that it's eligibility for elective office, I'm not sure that's accurate. But it's still not enough for me to say it's two subjects. It's more just, I guess, signaling that I think we should be a little bit more explicit about it because regardless of their intent, I think we probably should track the language.
Fair enough. I'd also note that we did have in the laundry list in the 76 opinion of things that fit under the single subject, the changes to vacancy filling procedures and the campaign finance. So I'm not sure that that's quite as entirely restrictive to the run-up and procedures of the recall as characterized. Do we have more questions or discussion, or do we want a motion?
Do you have anything?
Well, I suppose I'll just ask the proponent. Again, I don't know if this is dispositive or not. Is the intent of that provision, and by that provision I mean, I got ahead of myself. In section 2, subsection 9, recalled officials and those who resigned during a recall process shall not be any official for 6 years. Is the intent of this provision of this measure that any official means any state and local legislative and executive official, or any official elected, appointed, judicial, otherwise?
Everything in this measure, in the initiative, is subject to the definition at the very beginning of the initiative. So it would be restricted to legislative and executive elective offices.
Thank you.
You ready for a motion?
Sure.
I would move that we find that proposed initiative 2015-16 number 73, public accountability of officials, has a single subject.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Mr. Gruskin, did you have anything on the, I mean, obviously you do, but on the language of the...
I would only note, I mean, I know the board's gone over the provisions that we believe. This is a title that honestly does not connote to voters or petition signers what they're signing on to. And we think that the elements that are listed on pages 3 and 4 of our motion are essential in order to do that. I would note that the point that the chair raises about eligibility for office is something we raise under letter K, and we agree with the chair that at bare minimum, what we believe to be a substantive inaccuracy in the title needs to be corrected, but certainly the fact that there are these various changes that, well, we disagree with the board's decision on single subject, even if they were to comprise a single subject, are hidden from view, and we think they ought not to be.
Do you have a red line, or?
I don't think so.
No. Okay, thanks. Understanding that your hope was probably to win on the first prong of your motion.
Well, maybe we want to just go through.
Makes sense.
Or do you have ones you want to? I mean, the first one is title fails to state no local recall laws of any sort may be adopted. I think we usually treat that the other way around, which is when a local can opt out, then we put that in the question rather than stating you can't opt out. It's assumed you can't unless we say you can.
Okay. Chair, I would prefer, rather than going through all 8 or A through L, that we just focus on ones members believe have merit.
What do you
I think K we can talk about, but that's all the way at the end. I don't know if anybody has something earlier than that.
Is there,
Now, several of these kind of come under the same rubric. So the no local recall laws, no added recall requirements, changes. I mean, I don't think the changing formulas and things like that really matters much. But, I mean, is it worth it to add a couple of words to the single subject and say something like an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning the exclusive means of recalling elective officials?
I don't read the initiative that way. Maybe I'm incorrect, but it allows laws that don't conflict with this. I'm not sure it's appropriate to opine on.
Where is that?
That's Section 3, Enforcement.
Okay.
It shall supersede any conflicting state or local law. So presumably there could be either greater recall procedures or other recall procedures in addition. And I'm not willing to opine on the meaning of that, but I'm just saying I'm not sure it's accurate to say that this is an exclusive measure.
I think that's a good point.
And my view of those local issues is that it says specifically that it specifies recall and successor election procedures for state and local elective officials. I think that fairly implies to an average reader that this will affect local governments and local procedures.
So other than K, do any of us have concerns about these others?
I mean, I'm a little concerned about being able to put a number of people on one petition, but I'm not sure that the voters.
To me, I think because they're voted on separately.
It's just the petition process.
A process, and it's really a procedural matter.
What about that you can't be recalled again? Do you feel like we need to?
I do think there's the one about, yeah, I think the way we've phrased it is a bit misleading.
Okay.
I think I do agree with that argument. Because all we're doing, if you defeat a recall, is saying you can't be recalled again from that office for, I believe, 4 years.
Right.
And it's a lot of language to.
So we are dealing, I suppose, with the phrase that starts on line
three,
defining future eligibility.
Right.
Perhaps we should just split that into two.
Yeah. And or
saying defining future eligibility for elective office for recalled officials.
Semicolon.
Defining susceptibility to recall of officials.
Restricting
recall of officials who have already defeated a recall effort. That's better.
I think you can keep.
It's already in there, Steve.
I'm sorry?
Nothing. Oh, there you go. Helping the editor.
Oh.
Do we want to say, I don't know, maybe it's too much detail, but recall from the same office? Because what it really says is, you know, if you're a state rep, you can't be, you know, if you then move over to the Senate, you can get recalled.
I agree. So it read, restricting recall from the same office.
Or an official who
is. Mr. Spaulding, would you mind closing that door for us? Thank you.
I think, Steve, what I'd say is then for an official who has already defeated a recall.
I agree with that.
And up above, I do want to talk about taking out that a word elective in line 3, defining future eligibility for elective office. And I'd rather track the language of the measure, which is, is it say any office or?
Any official.
Defining future eligibility, maybe
shall
just
not be any official.
Maybe just for public office. I don't know.
Well,
I would simply say defining future eligibility for recalled officials. No, I suppose that doesn't work.
Yeah, for something.
I mean, I think at least the intent has been expressed.
I know, but I'm just not sure that that's gonna.
You think it's misleading in that?
I just don't know
that office could even include things that aren't elective.
I think it could end up being interpreted that way, and so I don't want to interpret it as elective when that's not the way he wrote it. I mean, it could be any public office.
This is Mike Spaulding. Should we put in legislative or?
No, I mean, that's even worse.
I know.
In my opinion, because I'm not sure that's what this does. And I don't like to get into the, you know, I don't like to put your intent into the question if that's, if it's questionable to me that that's how the court's going to interpret it. Shall not be any official. I mean, you don't even use the local legislative.
How about we say
this?
Or, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Stating that recalled officials shall not be any official for 6 years. That directly tracks the language. And I just, I just want to say for the record that I understand the intent of this measure and the section one of this measure to restrict the operation of this measure to the officials defined in section one.
Yeah, and I understand that to be the intent, too. I just.
And it seems to me like we'd have to interpret it either way. If we said any office, then.
Right.
So we're sort of stuck to tracking the language and.
I think so.
Letting the courts figure it out.
Yeah.
Okay.
I move the changes reflected on lines 3 through 5 with the red line.
Second.
All those in favor?
But the.
Oh. What?
I just didn't know if the objector had wanted to.
Oh, I think he's just looking.
Make a record before we voted. Sorry. I make that motion.
Did you second it?
Yes.
Oh. Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Did you have anything else?
I don't think I did.
All right, then the way it reads now is an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning recall of elective officials and in connection therewith specifying recall and successor election procedures for state and local elective officials, stating that recalled officials shall not be any official for 6 years, restricting recall from the same office for an official who has already defeated a recall effort, requiring opposition donations and spending to be public records, and prohibiting identification, reporting, or limiting of donations to recall campaigns and payments to recall petition circulators.
There's one last question. I am looking at objection L. Do we think, I mean,
yes, sir.
I do think to the extent that existing law isn't being changed, and I mean, I think that argument's at least worth discussing.
And Mike Spaulding, proponent. We agree with Mr. Gruskin that it's existing law, so there's no need to repeat that in the title.
And I think we had it before because the implication is, don't we have something here, remind me, that the proponents.
Yeah, they don't have to report.
Records.
Right, right.
So we actually probably, well, we've got that on the back. So we set it to contrast it.
Yeah.
Which is the intent of the measure, but.
I don't understand. Prohibiting identification. Well, then, maybe it is useful. I mean, even though it's arguably a little redundant, it's sort of not redundant in this context because it's showing that we're treating proponents and opponents differently. Is that important enough to?
I think line six, just as a total aside, it should say limitation instead of limiting, because otherwise it's and prohibiting limiting. I think it should read prohibiting limitations. I don't know. Just
would be
sound.
Yeah. I wouldn't put an S on it though. I would just limitation.
Or limitation. I don't know. Maybe limiting was better.
Oh,
it's kind of clunky.
I'm fine with the ION.
Okay.
Construction. I do have a question. It's existing law to require opposition donations and spending to be disclosed.
Right.
Is it existing law to require proponents?
Sure.
Yes. So that's a significant change.
Well, that's why we put it in there.
Right. Should we make that even more clear by specifying that donations,
I mean, we could say
campaign shall never be identified, reported, or
whatever. Well, we put that. We could say requiring only opposition donations. You know, if you wanted to further.
I think it because I should have been clear from the start, and I think this is the same thing that Jason was saying. I think the two need to be put in place to make clear that one is a change and one is not. I think it's fine as is, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
Well, do you want to just, after two on line five, you want to just say requiring opposition donations and spending to continue to be public records? Kind of makes it clear that the law's not changing. It still leaves it in there for.
Right. I don't object to that. That's fine.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
No. I don't have anything.
Move
else.
Those changes.
Second.
All in favor? You did it again.
Aye.
I don't know if you were asking or making the motion.
I was asking, but, you know, that works too.
Keep getting promoted.
Yeah. You can have it. All right. Then do you want to make the final motion, Jason, on the rehearing?
Sure. I move that we grant the motion for rehearing on proposed initiative 2015-16, number 73, only to the extent that we've made amendments to the title as they appear on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. And that takes us to proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 62, prohibition on use of hydraulic fracturing. And this is a rehearing. And if the proponents could come up first and just introduce yourselves and let us know that you're here for the record.
Thank you, Martha Tierney, on behalf of the proponents, Bruce Mason and Karen Dyke, who are present.
Thank you.
And they've already signed their affidavit for these two particular measures.
Okay. The petitioners for rehearing, if you could come forward and identify yourself, who you represent.
Good morning. My name is Matthew Tisau, and I'm here on behalf of objectors Tracy Bentley and Stan Dempsey.
Mr. Stone, would you clarify for the board? You're with Riley, Carlock, and Applewhite?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Kaufman was sick this morning, so he could not make the hearing.
Oh, all right. Well, we've read the motion for rehearing. Is there anything else you want to offer in addition to what Mr. Kaufman's filed?
We'd just like to stand on what we have filed so far and reiterate under the single subject requirement. We do believe that there are at least three separate subjects here. You know, there's the stated subject with the ban on hydraulic fracturing. But this initiative also brings up a second subject of reworking the federal constitution and rights underneath that, as well as a third subject of limiting property rights under Article 2, Sections 14 and 15 of the Colorado Constitution. For that reason, we believe that this fails under the single subject requirement.
Okay. Any questions on the board?
No, none at this time.
None for me.
All right, thank you. Ms. Turney, did you want to respond?
Thank you. The Supreme Court has spoken directly to these issues, specifically in Cordero versus Leahy. There are two cases that have the same caption, except one is for ballot title and submission clause 2013-2014, number 85. That's at 328 P3rd 136, page 143. And then the other is Cordero versus Leahy, in re title ballot title and submission clause for 2013-2014, number 90. And that's at 328 P3rd 155 161. In that case, those two cases, the court specifically stated that the not a taking provision is directly related to the subject of the initiative. And in that case, the subject of the initiative was local control measure. But because here it is, the subject of the initiative is a creation of a ban on hydraulic fracturing, the not a takings provision has no meaning separate and aside from the ban on hydraulic fracturing. It flows directly from that ban and does not have any meaning separate from that, absent the language of the measure or the provisions in the measure. Similarly, the not repugnant to the U.S. Constitution language is inoperative without reference to the prohibition on hydraulic fracturing here. It's not saying that the U.S. Constitution is not repugnant to everything. It's just to the provisions inside this measure. So neither of those create a separate subject from the single subject, which is the ban on hydraulic fracturing. And I believe the Supreme Court has made that fairly clear in those two cases.
Any questions on?
No.
None from me.
No. Okay. Thank you.
Ready for a motion?
Sure.
All right. I would move that the board finds the proposed initiative 2015-16, number 62, prohibition on use of hydraulic fracturing, has a single subject.
Second.
All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Actually, these would have made another good Groundhog Day group.
I think you just couldn't wait to have me on panel for these.
Maybe that was it. All right. Moving to the question, do you have comments on the text?
Again, this is Matthew Tiesel on behalf of objectors. And moving forward to this, the second portion of argument, that the title does encompass or the title is misleading as set. We would just again rely on the motion that we have filed and just bring your attention to the various provisions regarding the damages and penalties sections, as well as the vague and lack of definitions of the oil and gas provisions. I feel like those will be misleading to voters and would make this a difficult initiative for voters to correctly understand and not be misled when voting on it.
All right, thanks. Stephen, can you put the question up? Do you have anything on the text?
Sure. And thank you. And I wasn't here at the beginning, so I apologize for asking this question, but we were having technical difficulties. Okay. Mm-hmm. So if the proponents want to come up and look, is that okay with the
Yeah, we board? Tried to move the screen a little, but back there you can see over there or
okay.
you can, yeah.
So in response to the issues raised on the language of the title as set on this measure previously, I can run through them individually if that would make sense, unless you would like me to focus on particular ones.
Do members of the board have particular ones that you want to?
I was mostly concerned and focused on numbers 4 through 7.
Okay.
I think we discussed number 4 last time.
So what the title does reflect in the response to number 4, there was discussion last time about the actual language of the measure. And I believe what we settled on and what the title reflects is it does track the language, which states upon a determination that a violation of this article has occurred. Actually, let me go back. Section 5. The plaintiffs in such actions shall be entitled to recover all reasonable costs of litigation, including without limitation attorney's fees and costs. And then upon a determination that a violation has occurred, penalties may be assessed. We offered testimony that it was the intent of the proponents that the measure would apply to prevailing plaintiffs, not just to any plaintiff who brought an action. And I'll point the board to Cordero versus Leahy, 328 P 3rd 155 at 163, where the court made clear that it's appropriate for the title setting board when setting a title to consider the testimony of proponents concerning the intent and meaning of a proposal.
And I agree that that is the intent. I understand the discussion last time. I just wondered if the board thought that, as we did with the previous title, we should just use the language or something similar to the language rather than what is currently in the title.
I mean, I think we certainly had a pretty lengthy discussion on it before yeah. settling on the language that we did. I don't remember every detail of that discussion, but.
Okay. If the other members of the board aren't apt to change that language, then I won't suggest any change.
Yeah, I think I'm okay with it as
yeah,
is.
Yeah, I'm fine with it.
Okay. I do think the so that I think takes care of 4 and 5, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
And then 6 and 7 are also of a piece, and I think this could be dealt with pretty simply, which is just by saying in the phrase that says authorizing any person to sue to enforce the ban, perhaps adding and obtain damages. And leaving all else in the title the same. And I can explain why I think that works.
That sounds fine to us.
Okay. Why don't we add that?
Can you repeat that first?
So this would be on line 5, in the right, after to enforce the ban and obtain damages. And I move that, well, barring any statements by the proponents of the measure or the movement.
I only have, again, this is Matthew Tiesel for the objectors. I have one brief statement that, although it may be appropriate to consider the intent under Cordero, I think that given the discussion in this case and the fact that it was necessary to examine that and rely on it, I think it's still clear that this has a great chance of being misleading to voters under that language regarding the fees and costs. But otherwise, I have nothing further to add.
I move the change reflected on line 5.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And I certainly don't want to cut off the other board members, but I don't have concerns on numbers 1 through 3 of the objections, the specific language of the title.
And I don't have objections to those either. I do want to briefly comment on them. You know, first, in terms of objection 1 about the not repugnant to the Constitution of the United States, you know, I just feel that that amounts to a declaration. I mean, I know we don't talk about speculating too much, but we all are aware of the Supremacy Clause, and I think it's just, to the extent something in there really is repugnant to the Constitution of the United States, the courts will find it so. I want to talk about the second objection about the definition of, I'm sorry.
Oil and gas development?
Yes.
Well, that's two. Well, there are two twos, I guess. I just noticed that.
Yeah.
So really there are eight
that's
items.
Throwing me.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The two that talks about the failing to include a definition of oil and gas development. I mean, I think my thought is that looking at the definition, there's nothing in there that seems surprising or unusual relative to a common understanding of the term, which is why I don't think we need the detail. I bring it up just because on the next one, I think there may be more discussion of whether a similar objection is worth talking about more. That's it for me.
Well, I think on the oil and gas development definition, I mean, we went through a whole lot of discussion two years ago, about what term we should use, you know, fracking, hydraulic fracturing. I mean, and we finally settled on hydraulic fracturing because we wanted to get away from anything that could be a catchphrase, and we didn't want to get into, you know, and I guess it goes down to number 3. We certainly didn't want to get into, you know, somebody's speculation that this does or doesn't then get rid of 90% of oil and gas development
right.
in Colorado. I mean, that's really for the ads and, you know, the proponents and opponents to hash out in front of the electorate. But, you know, I think a lot of time went into that, and if I remember correctly, some compromise, and the court seemed to think that, you know, our discussion sort of fleshed that out. So I'm comfortable with where we ended up, and I'm actually kind of hesitant to add anything to that because it's not like these measures are that different from what we discussed 2 years ago.
Okay. Anything else? I think then I would move that we grant the motion for rehearing on proposed initiative 2015-16, number 62, prohibition on use of hydraulic fracturing, only to the extent that we've made a minor amendment to the title.
I second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 63, Right to Healthy Environment.
This is Martha Tierney, and I'll just represent that the proponents of the measure, Bruce Mason and Karen Dyke, are here and present, and they have signed their affidavits.
All right, and motion for rehearing is filed. Want to just state your name and who you represent?
Yes, again, it's Matthew T. Slough from Riley Carlock and Applewhite on behalf of objectors Tracy Bentley and Stan Dempsey.
Stephen Lenhart with Burns, Figa, and Will on behalf of movement Douglas Kemper, who's also here today.
Thank you. Do either of you want to supplement what you offered in your motion for rehearing?
Yes, we would like to do so.
Okay, go ahead.
With regard to the single subject question, Initiative 63 contains at least two subjects. First of all, creating a fundamental right to a healthy environment. This is the subject that's identified in the board's title, and clearly this is the initiative's primary purpose. The initiative defines healthy environment in Section 2 as safe and sustainable conditions for human life, including healthy air, water, land, and ecological systems. This phrase suggests typical subjects of state regulation, the state's police powers to protect public health, and it sets a single statewide standard. This definition is basically a yes or no standard. Either there are safe and sustainable conditions or there are not. It's not a sliding scale. It's not a right to healthier environments some places in the state than others. And other sections of the initiative also reflect this standard. Sections 1 and 3 give a right to the healthy environment. Section 4 directs governments to assign the highest priority to protecting a healthy environment. Same requirement on all governments. Section 6 allows persons or governments to enforce the right to a healthy environment. If the standard is met, it doesn't authorize people to sue for a healthier environment. The second subject is the imposition of local control over environmental regulations, essentially with preemption in reverse, the authority to supersede any less restrictive state environmental regulations. This is in Section 5 of the initiative and would essentially throw the state's preemption doctrine into reverse based on a test of which law is more protective. This is contrary to the statewide standard for the right to a healthy environment, which does not require any local laws to be more protective than that standard. So preemption is separate, distinct, and unrelated to the purpose of this initiative to create a right to a healthy environment, and it has no necessary or proper connection to the statewide standard.
I'm sorry, can I just jump in Yes. for a moment there? I'm a little concerned about some language in a somewhat similar initiative to this, the court on 2013-14, number 89.
Mm-hmm.
On page 11 said, further, we need not address Petitioner Kemper's argument that this section may fundamentally change the state's preemption law. Not only is the effect of an initiative outside of the scope of our review, but the mere fact that an initiative may create a change does not mean that it violates the single subject requirement. And then there's a little bit more citation, but how does that not control us here and basically serve as a direct order to us not to even consider the argument you're currently making?
Yes, I recognize that there are some similarities. However, Initiative 89 revolved around the establishment of a public trust and common property right. The current Initiative 63 says nothing about public trust or common property right. The court majority and the board's majority had held that Initiative 89 was a single subject because the local preemption provisions were, in their view, an enforcement mechanism for the public trust right, and particularly for the provision designating not only the state but also local governments to act as trustees. There's nothing similar in the current Initiative 63 that would tie local governments into having the ability to enforce their own standard that's different from the statewide standard that Initiative 63 would provide.
But doesn't that in some ways make this one simpler? I mean, if they said that the other one was a single subject, this one is just giving that fundamental right to any person, right? Isn't it almost less complicated because it's not creating a trust and...
Well, the initiative is less complicated by not establishing a public trust, but I think there's less of a basis to tie in the local preemption as an enforcement mechanism the way that the right to the healthy environment is defined. The preemption change doesn't serve to enforce any other section of the initiative. Rather, it's incongruous with other sections of the initiative because it directs courts to favor some local laws over state laws that would already protect the right to a healthy environment. Yet those state laws that are designed to meet the state standard would not control in any locality where a court finds local laws to be more protective. But that's not consistent with setting a statewide standard, which the first part of the initiative does.
But I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but mm-hmm. by limiting the preemption to the more restrictive, I mean, isn't that almost the definition of enforcement, saying, well, the state can enforce, but if the locals go even further to enforce, then they get to control?
It still flies in the face of what else this initiative does by setting a uniform statewide standard.
Go ahead. Do you have anything else?
I believe that's all I have on a single subject question.
Thank you. Do you have anything further on single subject?
Matthew Tisau on behalf of objectors, and no, we do not at this time.
Okay. Are you want some discussion, whatever you want?
No, I think.
I guess we need Miss.
Yes.
Ms. Tierney to respond. Sorry.
That's okay. Thank you, Martha Tierney, on behalf of the proponents. I think that the language in Cordero versus Leahy really does settle this question, and I would just echo Mr. Gallander's comments that the local governments have the power to enact laws that are more protective than the state, but that flows directly from the measure. It's not a standalone right granted aside from the fundamental right to a healthy environment. And I think that the language in Cordero versus Leahy in relating to number 90, where it talks about preemption, and then in the language quoted by Mr. Gallander and Kemper versus Leahy at 328 P3rd 172, settles this question.
I move to find that the measure continues to have a single subject.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All
right. Move to the language.
I think my only comment here would be in contrast to number 62. Healthy environment is something that can certainly mean a lot of different things. I have done a phrase search for it in the Colorado Revised Statutes and Constitution. It's not defined anywhere. And I think that this definition is not necessarily something that's sort of inherently obvious to the average voter. So I'd like to, at least for consideration, consider whether we would want to flesh that out more as suggested. I would note that in the title for 89, we did do that. We specified the environment. That was the public right to Colorado's environment, included clean air, pure water, natural and scenic values. That was upheld. I don't know that saying the right to a healthy environment, comma, defined as, quote, unquote, end comma, and just tracking the language is necessarily a bad or a too much language adding idea.
Yeah, well, I guess I think healthy could also be a catchphrase type. I mean, in the last question we went into, you know, air, water, scenic values. Here they talk about air, water, land, and ecological systems. Maybe we should just use what they put in here, much as we did when we set 89. Instead of saying healthy environment, just talk about
Oh, so you'd say natural person's fundamental right to safe and sustainable and then just track the language without. I don't think I have any issue with that.
Not even sure if I'd say safe and sustainable. I'm kind of struggling with that one. Sustainable can be kind of.
Could I interject for a moment?
Sure.
Because the title of the right that will be inserted into the Bill of Rights is right to a healthy environment, I think it would be important to include that. We don't have any objection to providing the definition as Mr. Gellender suggests. I agree they did put the definition in 89. Ironically, we had objectors there argued that the definition was a catchphrase, not that it needed to be inserted. They wanted it out. But we don't have any objection to including that definition if that would make it clearer. But I think that the fact that it is a right to a healthy environment is sort of central to the explaining what the measure is. So taking that language out, I think, would render it misleading.
I just want to disagree with you there, because I don't think that the language of a measure is determinative of whether or not that measure includes a catchphrase. I think that if a proponent of a measure came and said that we're going to include a right to good things in the Constitution, and that right to good things should be the single subject, we couldn't defer to that. In fact, the recall measure that we just considered this morning, we did not use the term public accountability because it was too broad, despite the fact of being sort of the title and the purpose of the measure. So all that to say, I agree with the other board members that changing the title and not using healthy environment would not necessarily make this misleading or be improper.
So are you suggesting that we would put the entire definition before the in connection therewith phrase?
I think so.
Or we could say that the subject is the right of local government to
I think there are a number of ways
related to the environment
do it.
Or anything.
Sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you.
No, go ahead.
I think there are a number of ways you could do it. You wouldn't necessarily have to use the definition. I think that's one option. You could say an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning the protection of the natural environment or protection of the environment or something to that effect. My only point is I don't think we have to use the phrase healthy environment in the title, and I don't think any case law compels us to.
I don't disagree with that.
So, Jason, do you want to suggest language that you think would be more appropriate?
It's like this wasn't even my thing. Why are you pushing it?
I mean, to me, I actually think what we have is pretty good. I was only suggesting the clarification, really, as a phrase set off with commas after healthy environment. I don't think we have any problem catchphrase-wise with what's in there right now. I think we could frankly not change it at all and be fine. I do think just because healthy environment is, you know, not something that there's a common understanding of as much as there was with, say, oil and gas development and our press in 89, that I would just put a comma after environment. Say defined as, put in the definition another comma, and then be done with it.
What did you?
I'm fine with either approach. I just wanted to make the legal point on the record. If we were to define it, I would prefer to add the definition after the "in connection therewith" phrase. So it would be defining healthy environment as safe and sustainable conditions for human life.
I'd put it right after the therewith, right?
That's what I would do too, yeah. I don't have a position on whether that's necessary. I
don't think it's necessary. I do think it's helpful.
I won't object if...
Yeah, I still don't like healthy environment. But if you two are fine with it, I'm not going to...
Well, I note that there wasn't an objection in the motion for rehearing to the use of that verbiage. That doesn't preclude us from considering it, but that wasn't the basis for objection.
Yeah.
So perhaps the safe course is just to include the definition.
Okay.
And I suspect we might hear an objection.
This is Steve Lenhart. I do agree with the course that a few of the board members have proposed to add the definition. Where it is added just after "in connection therewith," I believe, is appropriate. Let me just clarify for the record. I think we did have an objection to the repeated use of the phrase "healthy environment" without a definition.
Thank you.
And again, this is Matthew Tislau on behalf of objectors. Do not have an objection to adding the definition where it has been added there.
Okay.
I think the only other question I had is whether any of the board members thought it necessary to include the punitive damages feature of the proposal to the title.
I don't really think it's central, but I'm fine adding it. It's not that confusing of a question that we're going to.
I think "sue to enforce" is broad enough that it encompasses the equitable declaratory damages actions, including punitives. So I think I would overrule that objection.
Okay. You have any other changes?
No.
Okay. You have anything else, Ms. Attorney?
No.
Want
to
make a motion, then?
I move to adopt the changes reflected in lines 2 through 4 of the red line on the screen.
Second.
All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And can we just take a 5-minute recess before we get started?
Well, I think we should probably just do the motion officially.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. I'll read it. An amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning natural persons' fundamental right to a healthy environment and in connection therewith defining healthy environment as safe and sustainable conditions for human life, including healthy air, water, land, and ecological systems, requiring state and local governments to assign the highest priority to protecting a healthy environment, allowing local governments to enact laws that are protective of a healthy environment, stating that such a local law governs over a state law that is less protective of a healthy environment, allowing natural persons and governmental entities to sue to enforce the fundamental right to a healthy environment, and awarding reasonable costs of litigation upon determination that a violation has occurred.
I move that we, so we made an amendment. I move that we grant the motion for rehearing only to the extent that we have amended the title and adopt the title as, only to the extent that we have amended the title for proposed initiative 2015-16 number 63 concerning right to healthy environment.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right, we're going to take a 5-minute recess.
We have some administrative tasks to take care of, so okay. We may actually end up with a
Ten
little bit longer.